I want you to think for just a second. In your lifetime, how many really memorable sermons do you think you've heard? Now, I had the opportunity a number of years ago when John MacArthur was in town. We did a radio interview with him, and I drove him from the radio interview back to his hotel. And on the drive back, I remember asking him, I said, what do you think the preacher's primary job is? And he said, it's real simple in my mind. He said, the preacher's primary job is to make the scriptures memorable. And I thought, that's a good word. You know, to the extent that anyone occupies the pulpit, what you hope folks will leave with ringing in their ears is not the story that you told in the middle or the illustration you used at the beginning, but that you hope folks leave with the scriptures still implanted in their hearts and ringing in their ears. You want to make the scriptures memorable. And be an interesting exercise for you sometime this week in a quiet time, just to pull aside, get out a piece of paper, and stop and see if you could write down the memorable sermons you've heard in your life and see how many you come up with. You know, we might hope that maybe one of them would have come over the last year here, but I was thinking about it myself as I was putting this together and stopping to think. I can remember a sermon I heard at Scottsdale Bible Church in 1984 when we were living out in Scottsdale, when Darrell Del Housset preached on a Sunday night, and he was in John chapter 15. And here's the thing I remember. It was not that it was necessarily an eloquent or well-put-together sermon. It was that the Lord met me where I was, and the Word connected with what was going on in my life. And I think if you stop and think about it, what will stand out as memorable sermons is not the eloquence of the preacher, not his cleverness, but it's when God takes his word and applies it deeply and profoundly in your heart. Those are the memorable sermons, because the Spirit is at work in your life in the preaching of God's word. Now, we're going to look this morning, actually we're going to begin looking this morning at an account of what is undoubtedly the best known and most powerful and most memorable sermon ever preached by anyone. It's in Luke chapter 6. And I'm going to give you an outline of where we're going with where we are this morning. For those of you who grew up in a Southern Baptist church, I'm going to use alliteration so you'll feel comfortable, okay? The outline is we're going to look first at the place where the sermon was delivered. Then we're going to look at the purpose for the sermon. And finally, we'll examine the preamble of the sermon, the first few verses of it. So it's the place, the purpose, and the preamble that will be our outline. But let me take care of one question before we actually look at the text. And the question that comes up as we start to look at this particular sermon, which Mike called it the Sermon on the Plain. That's what a lot of Bible teachers call it. And it is less familiar, this account is, than the more familiar Sermon on the Mount from Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. And some people have wondered, is what Matthew's recording and what Luke records, are these separate recordings of the same event? Or are they a different event? And there's a lot of theological rambling about that. My sense is that what you have here is two separate sermons being recorded. And here's the reason why. Look at the very beginning of Luke chapter 6 at verse 17. The very first thing Luke says is he came down with them and stood on a level place. If you go to Matthew chapter 5, the very first thing you see is seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. Now, it's possible that he went up on the mountain and then came down to a level place on the side of the mountain, and we have the same event being recorded. That's possible. But I also know that Jesus preached a lot up and down the Jordan River Valley and around Galilee. As he went from town to town, there were lots of preaching opportunities. And I know that when I get an opportunity to go preach in a different town, I will often take a message that I've done and preach it again. And it won't be exactly the same the next time I do it as the first time I did it. In fact, 2 weeks from today, I'm going to be preaching at a church in Tulsa. They've got a pastoral search going on, and I'm helping with pulpit fill. I'm not going over to candidate. I'm just going over for pulpit fill over there. But I'm going to be preaching a message, the same message that I did here on Valentine's Eve. And I have a little longer time there than I had here. So I'm going to say some things there that I didn't get a chance to say here. Well, I think what we have recorded here is probably an earlier version of what Matthew records later as the full Sermon on the Mount. I think Jesus probably preached this message in a number of different settings on a number of different occasions. And it's also realistic to think, or we also need to keep in mind that Matthew was an eyewitness to the Sermon on the Mount, right? Luke was not an eyewitness to any of this. Luke's getting all of his information from testimonies from other people. So it's possible that Luke never even heard about the Sermon on the Mount, but was sitting with a guy one night who was recollecting. He said, I remember this one time when Jesus was preaching. It was right after he had chosen the 12 as the apostles, and he went in and told the account of what Jesus had preached. Now, I'm not sure it really matters one way or another, whether it's two different accounts of the same thing, but there are some differences between these accounts, and one of the differences comes right up this morning when we look at the Beatitudes found in Luke, and we compare them with the Beatitudes found in Matthew. Luke only has four Beatitudes. Matthew has nine. And Luke contrasts his four Beatitudes with four statements of woe that are completely absent from Matthew's gospel. So all of that leads me more than 2,000 years later to look back and say, I think this may be two different accounts. But you can disagree, and that's fine. Let's look first at the place where this sermon was preached. Verse 17 starts, it says, he came down with them and stood on a level place. A great crowd of the disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem, from the seacoasts of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out from him and healed them all. All right, stop right there. You got the setting, right? Jesus has been up on the mountain all night to pray. Then he appoints the 12 from among his disciples. He calls out 12 to be his apostles. And then it says after that he comes down the mountain after this night of praying, and he comes down to this level place. And with him are not only the 12, but it says also his disciples. And then there's this multitude. Jesus has been preaching now long enough throughout the Jordan River Valley and throughout Galilee that news of his ministry has started to spread. And people from the old southern kingdom, Judea, Jerusalem, that area, people from the north, from Galilee, and all up and down the Jordan River Valley are hearing about this one who might be the Messiah. And so they are coming out to hear him because there's news that at least a prophet has emerged in our lifetime, and maybe it's the Messiah. And so a great multitude, Luke says, even people from Tyre and Sidon have come all the way to hear Jesus preach. It also says that they came not just to hear him, but they came to be healed. And Luke differentiates between those who had diseases and those who had unclean spirits. As a doctor is likely to do, he could tell the ones who he'd seen these diseases, and he could tell the ones who were demonized or demon-possessed. And it says that Jesus healed them all, and that power was coming out from him to heal them. Now, we know a couple of things by reading the gospel. We know that Jesus didn't always heal everybody, right? You take the account at the pool of Bethsaida, there were many sick there. There's only one who was apparently healed. Jesus didn't always have just kind of power coming out from him that he was not in control of. It's not like all you had to do was get close to him and you'd get healed. Although, remember the woman with the discharge who thought, if I can just touch the hem of his garment. Well, the crowd was pressing in on him. She's the only one we know of who had an illness and was healed. So the healing of Jesus was a sovereign and a divinely appointed had a sovereign and divinely appointed purpose and didn't just happen indiscriminately. I think it's not inconsequential that this particular time of great healing and healing not only the demon-possessed but also those who had disease is the prelude to the delivery of this message. This is to authenticate what Jesus is about to preach. Jesus is about to preach something that is so revolutionary and goes so against what the scribes and the Pharisees have been teaching people throughout Jerusalem and Judea and throughout all of Israel, that the healing ministry of Jesus is designed here to cause people to go, we better pay attention to this guy. God is validating or authenticating what is about to be preached. I think there's one other thing we need to be aware of here. I think that Jesus is also serving before he preaches. I think he is caring for the needs of people before he delivers the message. Now, I wouldn't want to take this too far, but I do think there's a wise pattern here that before we engage people with the truth, we have first served them. We have first cared for them. We have first demonstrated our love for them. Steve Brown says, before you come to proclaim, people need to know that you've wept with them. Jesus, before he pronounced judgment on Jerusalem, wept over Jerusalem. Before you pronounce judgment, you need to weep. And I think there's a reality there that's good for each one of us to remember, that before we come to preach or to evangelize or to share truth, we need to have first been people who have served. Now, I don't think that means you can't be led of the Spirit to share with somebody who you haven't served first, but I do think it's wise in most settings to ask the question, how can I love and serve somebody and demonstrate that before I preach to them? That's a part of what seems to be going on here. I read a book a number of years ago by a guy who was a part of the Reagan White House. His given name, his parents had named him Colonel. I don't know why they didn't name him General. I guess they didn't have enough ambition for their son. But they named him Colonel. Colonel Doner was his last name. And he was in the Reagan White House. He was part of, in the late 1970s, there was what was called the Reagan Revolution. All these new conservatives were emerging, and Christians were a part of it, and they thought, if we can just get our guy in the White House, then we can bring about all of the social change that we believe needs to happen. And Colonel Doner was one of those guys. And he said 6 years after he had been in the White House, he left, and he was scratching his head going, we got our guy in, and things are no better. In fact, in some cases, they're worse. Why? And he started to pull back and say, how does social change happen? Does it happen on a political level, or does it happen in some other way? He wrote a book called The Samaritan Strategy. And his thesis in the book was that serving is how you earn the right to influence cultural change. He talked about how the Samaritan served and earned the right to speak, to be held up as an example. Actually, he talked about Mother Teresa speaking at the National Prayer Breakfast many years ago. I don't know if you saw this. I remember seeing it on TV. Mother Teresa came and spoke during the Clinton administration, and I'll never forget the sight of her standing up at the podium with Bill and Hillary on this side and Al and Tipper Gore on this side, and in the middle of her message, she said, please don't kill your babies. Please give them to me. I'll find someone to take care of them. And the crowd stood to its feet in applause, except for four people who kind of nervously fumbled with their silverware. She had earned the right to be a prophet in that setting because of her legacy of service. And I think it's wise for each one of us to stop and ask the question, how are we proclaiming only, or are we serving and proclaiming? I think that's part of what Jesus is modeling here. All right, so that's the place where this took, where this happened. And I want to suggest to you that most people, we're going to look at the purpose of the sermon here. I think most people who read the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain don't understand what Jesus' purpose in it is. And I would say that's true for those who are outside the church, but I think it's also true for those in the church, that most of us, when we read this, we don't understand the bigger picture that's going on here. And I'll explain what I mean, but before I do that, I want to just read through verses 20 through the end of the chapter. Now, that's a long passage to read, but I'm going to read it to you because I want you to get a sense of what it was that Jesus preached to the crowd. Verse 20 says, and he lifted up his eyes on his disciples and said, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, and when they exclude you and revile you and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For so their fathers did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets. But I say to you, who hear, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. To one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who begs from you, and from one who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. And as you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. If you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. Judge not, lest you be judged. Condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put in your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. He also told them a parable. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into the pit? A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, "Brother, let me take out the speck that is in your eye," when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you'll see clearly to take the speck that is in your brother's eye. For no good tree bears bad fruit, nor again does any bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from the bramble bush. The good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good. The evil person out of the evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I tell you? Everyone who comes to me and hears my word and does them, I will show you what he is like. He's like a man building his house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. And when the flood arose, the streams broke against the house and could not shake it because it had been well built. But the one who hears and does not do them is like a man who built his house on the ground without a foundation. When the streams broke against it, immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great. That's a powerful sermon. And probably as I read it, you thought, well, what does that mean? Well, what does that mean? How does that work? What am I supposed to do there? Well, we're going to have some chance over the next several weeks to unpack some of what that means. But I want you to see what I think is the bigger picture of this sermon. Keep in mind, the crowd that is hearing this sermon has been taught for years by the scribes and the Pharisees that if you follow the standards we've set for you, you will experience God's favor and blessing in this life and in the next life. Basically, what they've said is, if you will act like us, you will be blessed like us. That's been their message. And so the common man in Israel has been saying, okay, I guess we need to try to do what the scribes and the Pharisees are doing. And if they would go to a scribe and Pharisee say, I'm trying to do everything you're telling me to do, and I'm not getting the blessing like you're getting it. What they meant by that was, I'm not as rich as you guys are, or I don't have as much prosperity as you have. Then the scribes and the Pharisees would begin to examine why they weren't getting it. It was kind of the prosperity gospel of its own day. That was the message. Now here comes Jesus, and he's saying something completely different. He's teaching something that is obviously powerful and profound and important and should affect the way we live as believers. But I think what he's communicating in this sermon can be summarized this way. First, I think he's saying God's standards for his people are different than what the scribes and the Pharisees have been teaching you. They're teaching you to follow a bunch of rules. God has more important, higher priorities for you. And he speaks to what some of those are. Second thing he's trying to say is that not only are God's standards different, But God, what God expects of you is well beyond what you're able to do. He's raising the bar. The scribes and the Pharisees have been trying to say, okay, we'll lower it to get as many people in as possible. Now here comes Jesus. He says, you can't do everything that God's asking you to do. Now, if somebody preaches a sermon and says, here's what God's expecting, you can't do it, then what's the obvious response to that? Well, what hope do I have? Where is there any hope? How do I get help? Which is exactly what Jesus wants people to think of at the end of this sermon. So while he is laying out what I think is a valid ethical standard for people, his main purpose in this sermon is not to say, now shape up. His main purpose in this sermon is to say, you see that God's priorities are different than your religious leaders are telling you, and guess what? You can't be good enough to do it. Why would he leave people there? Because the next question they'll ask is, well, then what hope is there? And he's the guy with the answer to that. I think a lot of people look at the Sermon on the Plain or the Sermon on the Mount today and they think, this is my standard for ethical behavior. You'll hear people say, I try to live my life according to the Sermon on the Mount. I try to live my life according to the Golden Rule, which is in the Sermon on the Plain, right? And the obvious answer to that is, how's that working for you? And if we're honest, we would say, well, I don't always do it, but I try. Jesus is saying, that's not the message from God. Just try your hardest and everything's okay. He's saying, here's what God expects, and you should be hopeless as a result of this. I think the sermon here is a statement of a kind of ethical behavior that will be characteristic of those who are followers of Jesus, but he's not preaching this sermon to say, here's the standard, now go do your best to live this way so God will be pleased with you. In fact, if somebody hears this and says, well, I just need to clean up my act a little bit and I'll be okay, then they've missed it. His purpose here is to declare that God's priorities are different than what the religious leaders have said and to show people how far short of those priorities they fall. So, with that as our understanding of the purpose, let's look at the prologue, verses 20 through 26. We've already read these verses. I mentioned that these Beatitudes, there are four of them in Luke. Matthew has nine. Matthew's Beatitudes, interestingly, Matthew's Beatitudes tend to focus on things that we would think of as positive. Blessed are the pure in heart. Well, that's a good thing. Everybody wants to be pure in heart, right? Or blessed are the meek. That seems like a good thing. Here, Luke says, blessed are the poor, the hungry, the sorrowful, and those facing rejection. Luke just kind of cuts to all of the bad stuff. And Matthew's list seems, or Luke's list seems more stark and physical. In Matthew, Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Here he just says, blessed are the poor. Now, I think we need to understand that, and we'll pull that apart here in just a second, but that's just one of the differentiations. Kent Hughes, who was a pastor and a Bible teacher, said that these four Beatitudes in Luke were directed toward his disciples, Jesus speaking to his disciples. That's what verse 20 says. But they're four spiritual bombs that blow away the shallow talk of discipleship and call for a deeper level of commitment on the part of his followers. He's saying to his followers, you want to be my disciples? It's deeper than you think. It's going to require more than you expect. So the first beatitude in Luke's gospel, verse 20, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. And then jump down to verse 24, woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Each of the beatitudes has a corresponding woe. Blessed are the poor, woe to the rich. Blessed are the hungry, woe to the satisfied. You see, it goes through there. Let's talk about this word blessed for just a second. Greek word is makarios. And it, in some translations of the Bible, they'll use the word happy there, and I don't really like the word happy because in our culture, happy tends to mean when things are going well, I'm happy. Blessed goes deeper than that. In fact, I think what we're talking about here is a person recognizing that he has a state of contentment and well-being in his soul because of God's grace. To be blessed is to say, I am content and there's well-being in my soul because of God's grace. So when Jesus says, blessed are you who are poor, he's saying even though you're poor, you still have contentment and a sense of well-being in your soul because of God's grace in your life. That's why it sounds paradoxical, But he's saying it's not your circumstances that lead to you being blessed. It's God's grace that caused you to be blessed. We could look at these verses and say, if we were doing the Amplified version, it would say, it may not seem like it, and you may have been taught differently, but God's favor is with you if you're poor. That's what he's saying when he's saying blessed. It may not feel like it right now, and you may have been taught differently, but if you are poor in spirit, God's favor is with you. Now, Jesus' opening statement here would have grabbed the attention of the crowd very quickly. This is a bombshell-type statement to this crowd for a number of reasons. Because, first of all, it was commonly thought that if you were economically rich, you were experiencing God's blessing. And if you were economically poor, it was an indication that God was not pleased with you. There was a tie to that. And there's some Old Testament reality to that, right? Was Abraham rich or poor? Was rich. David, rich or poor? Rich. Solomon, rich or poor? Rich. You see, you got a lot of spiritual leaders who were rich people. And so you grow up as a Jew in Jesus' day, and you think, I guess if you're rich, you get to be king, or, you know, there's some correlation. There's some connection between the blessing of God and wealth. Not only that, but the scribes and the Pharisees, who were the religious elite of their day, they were rich. These were people who were well off. How do we know that they were all well off? Well, you know that they're well off because when Jesus needs a tomb, one of the scribes and the Pharisees has a plot for him. They have possessions, they have money and wealth. So here's this opening line to the sermon. Whole crowd's there, and I believe there are some scribes and Pharisees that are part of the crowd. And Jesus says, God's favor is with the poor. He might have just as well said, you guys are phonies. Because that was the net effect. God's favor is with the poor, for they will inherit the kingdom of God. That's slapping part of the crowd right out of the box. Okay? Is he saying here that God's favor is with those who are financially poor? Well, if you understand this word, there is both the sense of being poor in spirit and the sense of being economically poor. And the Bible indicates that when you are economically poor, there is some spiritual benefit to being economically poor because you realize your need often more than when you're financially prosperous. In fact, there are a number of places in the Bible where you see this connected. Now, in the Old Testament, there are places where it talks about, David says, I am poor and needy. Well, he's not poor and needy, he's doing fine. But when he says I'm poor and needy, he's saying, I recognize my own spiritual need. And in Proverbs, the term poor is often juxtaposed with the term proud. You have the poor and the proud. So there is a biblical understanding of poor that goes beyond economic poverty to spiritual poverty, which is at the heart of what Jesus is talking about. This is not primarily an economic message. It's primarily a spiritual message. But at the same time, there's some connection. The Bible says that the love of money is what? The root of all kinds of evil. The Bible says it's easier for a rich man to enter the kingdom, easier for a rich man to enter, or more difficult for a rich man? More difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom. I was getting it mixed up. Than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. James 5, if you look there, it warns those who are rich that misery is coming their way because they have gained their riches unjustly and because they've lived in luxury and indulgence while others have been in need. And in Timothy, 1 Timothy 6, there's this passage where Timothy says, Paul says to Timothy, you're to warn those who are rich in this world not to be haughty, not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who provides everything, to do good, to share, to be generous, to be ready to share. And listen to this warning from Revelation chapter 3, the church at Laodicea. You don't need to turn here. But here's what Jesus says to this church. That is a rich church. He says in verse 16, because you are, no, verse 17, for you say, I am rich, I have prospered, and I need nothing, not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire, so that you may be rich, and white garments, so that you may clothe yourself, and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes so that you may see. He basically says, you see yourself as rich. The reality is you're poor, and if you want to get rich, you have to buy refined gold from me. When Jesus is saying to the poor that they're blessed, he's saying, you're blessed because you realize you're poor. And when you realize you're poor, you're ready to buy the real gold that comes from him. So that's where this whole thing starts. Economic poverty is not what Jesus is promoting here, but the economically poor may be much more aware of their need for and dependence on God. You know, we recite the Lord's Prayer and we say, give us this day our daily bread. But how many of you are really worried that if God doesn't provide bread for you today, there won't be anything to eat? You're going, yeah, I got food at home. Even if I didn't, I can go to a restaurant. I got money. Most people in the world today who pray, give us this day our daily bread, aren't sure they're going to have it. So there is a dependence on God that is a part of what Jesus is saying. You're blessed when you realize you depend on God for everything. When you realize how bankrupt you are, spiritually bankrupt, how needy you are, how you depend on God for everything. That's where blessing starts. And I think that's what Jesus is saying in the corresponding woe in verse 24. Woe to you who are rich, for you've received your consolation. In the same way that blessed means that you're content and happy and enjoying a state of well-being, woe has an unusual meaning. We toss that word around without really understanding the full effect. And you say, woe to you, you know, woe. That word in Jesus' day meant I am worthy of hell. I am under the curse of God. That's what woe to you or woe to me means. It wasn't just watch out, danger, beware, which is what we tend to think. It was, man, you're in trouble. You are in serious spiritual trouble and you don't even realize it. So you're blessed, those of you who are poor, because you recognize your spiritual need. You people are in serious spiritual trouble and you don't even realize it because you're rich. And you don't see your need for God because you got stuff in your pocket. I did a radio interview this past week, actually 2 weeks ago, with a guy who's a financial counselor. And he told me that recently he has spoken with a client who has been out of work for more than 6 months. And here's what the client said. He said, you know what? Life is good. He said, first of all, it's simpler than it's ever been. He said, a lot of things we used to have to make choices about, we don't have any choices to make anymore. It's just real simple. But he said, more than that, my time with the Lord has been so deep, so rich, so sweet during this time. I've grown closer to him during this time. I got to tell you, I think we're headed into a time when there are going to be more people who are going to realize their dependence on God because of the current economic situation. I don't know what's coming. I'm not a prophet. I listen to the news on one channel and then the news on another, and I get confused like you do, right? One economist says this, another economist says that. We're going to be in this for the next 5 years. No, it's going to be over by the end of the year. You know, we're hearing all of this stuff. More layoffs, but not too many. It's only going to be, well, I don't know what the Lord's doing, but I do know that I think too many of us have a tendency to rely too much on money and stuff. And I think one of the great things that God is doing is he is exposing the false idol of mammon for what it is. If your security is there, watch. I can take that away, God says. If your hope is there, watch. It's gone. If your love is there, it will never satisfy. Blessed are the poor. I kind of wish Tom and Curtis were here this morning, and they're going to share in 2 weeks. They're not here because they're sharing with the church this morning about their trip to Myanmar. They're going to share that with us here in 2 weeks. But I kind of wish they were here this morning because they could tell you about the blessedness of those they come in contact with in Myanmar, whose lives are simple, whose needs are real, but who experience the joy of the Lord in a way that I wonder if some of us will ever get close to, right? Well, look at the second beatitude. The corresponding statement of woe. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. And then in verse 25, woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. So it's the juxtaposition. And there's a tie between being poor and being hungry, isn't there? Just as in the next beatitude, there's a tie between, what's the next one? What's the next one say? You weep. Blessed are you who weep, and blessed are you who are persecuted. There's a tie there. So these two are coupled together. But here's, blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. And as with the first beatitude, there's a parallel in Matthew's gospel that gives us a little more inclination that this is a spiritual issue. In Matthew's gospel, blessed are you who hunger and thirst, what? For righteousness. So this is not just blessed are you when your stomach is growling for food or for desserts during Lent, right? Or carbs. Blessed are you when your stomach is growling for justice and righteousness. First, to be a channel of justice and righteousness in your world, that's the first thing you should be hungry for. And secondly, to see that lived out in our world. There should be a longing in our heart for justice and righteousness to reign on the earth. Why? Because that's a part of what the King brings, and we should be a channel. There should be a hunger in our hearts to be channels of justice and righteousness. When Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are you who hunger and thirst for righteousness' sake, I think what he's saying is not just that you have a longing to see justice and righteousness happen, but that you have a longing to be a part of it. You have a longing to be a channel of God's justice and his righteousness. God's favor and presence is with those who have a longing or a growling stomach to become a channel of justice and righteousness. Now, here's a question. Is that you? Do you have a growling in your stomach to see justice and righteousness lived out in your community, in your country? And if you do, what have you done lately to try to feed that hunger? What are you doing to help those who need help? Now, I got to be real careful here, right? Because there is a tendency on the part of some in Christianity today to say that's what Christianity is all about, helping the poor. And we see people drift away from the proclamation of the gospel when they turn their attention to what's been referred to as the social gospel. Take care of the needs of the poor and you're fulfilling the ministry of Jesus. And so some of us, because we believe so clearly that the central message of the Christian faith is the message of reconciliation found in the cross and in the gospel, some of us tend to concentrate there, and we want to be careful not to be too social gospel for fear people will misunderstand us. Well, I believe we need to be both, full on. I believe that we need to be fully engaged as channels of righteousness and justice in our world, as well as proclaimers of the gospel. When Marianne and I are looking at relief agencies and asking the question, should we support a relief agency, we want to know two things. How effective is their relief effort, and do they preach the gospel? And if both of those aren't true, then we don't want to support them. And I think that needs to be a part of our thinking. You know, you stop and think about it, and I almost hesitate to even share some of these statistics for fear I'll be misunderstood, but the 225 richest people in the world, you take their accumulated wealth. The 225 richest people in the world, here's how much their wealth is worth. Now you take 47% of the world's population, and it's equal to the 225 people. I'm not trying to set up class envy here and say these people should be forced by the government to redistribute their wealth. That's really not what I'm trying to say. But I'm saying that these 225 people, if they don't have a heart for social justice, woe to them. Because there's a lot of need out here. I think all of us need to ask ourselves, do we really hunger and thirst for justice and righteousness? And what will we do for the oppressed? And what will we do for the least of these? And I don't know what you need to be doing, but I think you should ask, is there one thing we are doing or should be doing? You sponsor a child? Do you help volunteer down at the food bank that Mosaic has? Do you bring stuff to give there? What are you doing in your world to help those who are oppressed and those who are poor? I'm talking a lot about radio interviews, but a lot of these come to mind as I'm putting these sermons together. We did an interview one time with Graham and Trina Kerr. Does anybody know who Graham Kerr is? Who is he? The Galloping Gourmet. How many of you are going, what are you talking about, the Galloping Gourmet? Yeah, some of you. You younger people. Oh, well, some of you older people. Okay, all right. There was a big cooking show 20 years ago, and the Galloping Gourmet was kind of the Julia Child. He was in the kitchen cooking up all kinds of stuff. His wife was the executive producer of that show. And she had, about 18 years ago, she had a heart attack and a stroke and learned that she had adult onset diabetes and hypertension. and she realized she needed to make some lifestyle changes. So in a conversation with her husband, Graham, he said, we talked about it, and we said, wouldn't it be cool if we could take the stuff that we used to eat that harmed you, and instead of buying and eating that stuff, we'll take the money that we used to spend on that, and we will send it to people who are in desperate need, a child who's dying somewhere and needs help. He said, so that's what we did. We just made the decision that we're not going to buy this stuff. We're going to take that money and we're going to send it to folks in need. He called it living, instead of living indulgently, we decided to live outdulgently. I like that phrase. And he said, over the last 18 years, we've given $30,000 away to help with relief through stuff that we've organized. And you know what? Two things have happened. We've gotten healthier, and so have other people, by choosing to live outdulgently. I think we have to ask ourselves the question, what would Jesus have us do to be channels of justice and righteousness? Remember what Jesus said in John to the woman who came to the well? She came to get water, and Jesus said, would you like to have water that you'll never be thirsty again? Or when Jesus in John's gospel said, I am the bread that comes down from heaven. Whoever eats of me will never hunger again. Ultimately, when he says, blessed are you who are hungry, for you will be filled, he's saying, if you recognize the growling in your stomach for justice and righteousness, and the growling in your stomach that only I can satisfy, the growling for righteousness in your own life, ultimately, I'm the only one who can satisfy that. But if you're full and don't even recognize your need, woe to you. Woe to you. All right, let's look at the third beatitude and woe. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. See it in 21 and 25? This is not Jesus saying, you better not laugh. This is not a condemnation of joy or laughter. It's really a question of being spiritually aware and mourning for your own spiritual condition. It is not more spiritual to have a long face than to have a smile, is it? A joyful heart is what? It's good. It's like a medicine. The joy of the Lord is what? Our strength. We should go out with joy. Joy is a fruit of the Spirit. Jesus is not saying you better put away all that joy and just mope around. In Ecclesiastes, says there is a time for joy and a time to mourn. When you think of weeping or mourning in the Bible, what causes people to weep or mourn in the Bible? Sin. That's right. The prophets wept and mourned and put on sackcloth and ashes because of the sins of the nation, right? Anything else? Death. Death causes people to weep and mourn, and there's wailing, and you go hire the mourners to mourn when somebody dies in the Bible. And a part of that is because sin and death are connected. You're not just mourning the loss of a loved one, but you're mourning the condition of mankind that causes death to even happen in the first place. The only reason people die is because there's sin. So when somebody dies, we mourn not just for the loss of that person, but for the reality of sin and the consequences of it in the fact that there's death in the first place. So there's the death of a loved one, there's unfaithfulness. People mourned or wept when they were personally broken or repentant. Psalm 51, David is mourning, he's weeping because of his own sin. Now, what causes you to weep? What causes you to mourn? I heard a song a number of years ago. I'll just read a part of the lyrics of this song. A guy named Larry Bryant wrote a song called Life Goes On. He said, Mommy cried her eyes out when she burned the roast. Daddy's losing sleep over his golf. The children seem to be the most upset. Their favorite TV show's been taken off. Mommy screamed and pouted when she broke her nail. Daddy got depressed when his team lost. The children cried and cried when Doggy lost his tail. Then there's a verse that says, Meanwhile, the missionary came to show his slides, pictures of the starving godless tribes. We could barely keep ourselves awake. Now he's gone. Life goes on. You have to stop and ask, what causes us to weep and mourn? What gets you excited? What causes you to mourn? If your team loses, do you cry more than you weep over the lost condition of a loved one? Jesus says, blessed are you who mourn for your own sin and for the sin of the world, because there's comfort coming in him. But if you laugh now and ignore that, woe to you. Psalm 30 says, weeping is for the night, but what? Joy comes in the morning. Joy comes in the morning. The final blessing and woe centers on the reality that we will be persecuted for our faith. Verse 22, blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and revile you and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for so their fathers did to the prophets. And then in verse 26, woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets. Now, the reality is the Bible talks about this theme of being persecuted for our faith all through the New Testament. Jesus in John 15 says, if they persecuted me, guess what? They're going to persecute you. Paul tells Timothy that everybody who wants to live a godly life is going to face persecution. The point is, persecution for your faith should not take you by surprise. Jesus says, you will be hated or excluded or reviled or insulted, finally totally rejected because you're a follower of Christ. And this beatitude says, when you experience persecution, you are blessed. It's an indication that God's favor is with you when people are persecuting you, not just if they're persecuting you, but notice it says persecute you on account of the Son of Man. Some of you are getting persecuted just because you're being a jerk, okay? I mean, that's a reality. Some people face, I'm being persecuted. Well, that's just because you're not acting right. Now, if you're persecuted on account of the Son of Man, that's a different deal. And you're blessed, and in fact, you're so blessed that what your response ought to be is that you ought to leap for joy. Doesn't that just sound ridiculous that anyone would go, guess what happened today? I was persecuted for Jesus. Woohoo! I mean, it just sounds absurd to us. Why would you leap for joy when you face persecution? Well, Jesus says, because your reward in heaven will be great. And he says, not only is there a coming great reward, but also, he says, now you get to identify with the prophets. This happened to the prophets. Guess what? You're in the big leagues now. You've stepped up to prophet status as a result of this. You all know who Tony Dungy is, right? Coach of the Indianapolis Colts football team 2 years ago when he won the Super Bowl. You all know Tony is outspoken about his Christian faith. He doesn't hide the fact. I don't think he's obnoxious about it. He's just outspoken about it. So 2 years ago, after he won the Super Bowl, a guy named Jonathan Zimmerman wrote an op-ed piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer where he blasted Dungy. Why? He says, because this guy has the audacity to suggest that his Christianity is the only legitimate faith. He is upset because as a Christian, Dungy opposes same-sex marriage. Now here's what he wrote. He says, Dungy has every right to endorse his campaign in the name of his Christianity. But most people who support gay marriage are Christians too. And they're every bit as Christian as Tony Dungy. So are the millions of Christians who reject the idea that we'll all burn in hell unless we get born again. Tony Dungy says he follows the Lord's way, and more power to him. But there are many different ways to follow the Lord, and Dungy's isn't any better than yours or than mine. Now, you could wake up as Tony Dungy and read the Philadelphia Inquirer and go, oh man, I didn't sign up for this. He should have gotten out of bed that morning and leapt for joy. He's being persecuted. Why? Because he says, I love Jesus, and Jesus is the Savior, and he's the only way. And we should live our lives according to what the Bible teaches. And a guy in the Inquirer says, you have your religion, but don't force it on anybody else. Jesus says, blessed are you when you're persecuted for my name's sake. There was a season in Charles Spurgeon's life when he was a preacher, when he was depressed because of criticism that he was receiving for his preaching. So his wife took a sheet of paper, and she wrote this verse, blessed are you when you are persecuted, and she put it on the ceiling above the bed. So that every night when he went to bed, that's what he had to read. Jesus may be foreshadowing for his disciples in this verse what's coming for them. They will face persecution and they will face death. Then it says, woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets. And note, it's not just having people speak well of you, it's having all people speak well of you. That's what you don't want. You don't want all people. If everybody's speaking well of you, then it may be an indication that you're not standing as you ought to be standing for your faith. Now, Have you noticed that in this prologue to the Sermon on the Plain, there are only two kinds of people pictured? There are those who are experiencing the blessing of God, the blessed, and those who are in danger, the woe. There's not some middle ground that Jesus is talking to. It's not the extreme religious folks over here and the extreme blasphemers over here, and then there's this whole group in the middle that you're kind of little blessed, little woe. No. There's two groups. Those who are experiencing the blessing of God and those who are experiencing or are in danger of God's judgment. And you know, in Jesus' day, there were only those two groups in the crowd. There were the scribes and the Pharisees who were in danger of God's judgment and their followers. And then there were the common Jews who were listening to Jesus and they were trying to decide, they were trying to make up their mind. Do I follow him or do I follow them? And Jesus is saying, the blessing of God is in what I'm telling you. It's not in what they're telling you. It's a real clear division. Jesus drew a clear line in the sand and he was asking everybody in the crowd, which side are you going to be on? You're going to follow me, you're going to follow them. You're going to follow what the culture is telling you, you're going to follow what I'm telling you. And each one of us here this morning, I think, has to recognize that line in the sand is there for every person today. Do you understand that you are poor in spirit and desperately spiritually needy? Is that how you see yourself? Or have you allowed comfort, riches, wealth, culture to lull you into a sense that you're safe and secure? Has it become an idol? And instead of trusting in the Lord and being dependent on him totally, you find that you're only dependent on him when things get tough. If you're totally dependent, it's an indication that God has already blessed you. If you're not, you're in danger. Do you long to be a channel for righteousness and justice? First of all, do you long to see God make you righteous and just as a person? And then do you long to be a channel of his righteousness and justice for others? Or do you really not care all that much about that? If you care, it's an indication that the blessing of God is already there. If you don't, then you're in danger. Do you mourn for your own sin? For sin that destroys the lives of others? Do you grieve when people you know refuse to turn from sin, to forsake their selfishness? Or do you drift toward kind of a self-righteous, smug, well, it serves them right? You ever found yourself saying that? But if that's how they're going to act, serves them right. Or do you mourn for them? If you mourn, it's an indication that God's blessing's with you. If you get smug and self-righteous, you're in danger. You find yourself downplaying your own faith to get the acceptance of a boss or a friend or someone you know. Do you ever soften your stand for Christ just to gain the approval of men? I'm not suggesting we all get obnoxious. Just be careful. Are we selling out? Do you recognize persecution will come and say, that goes with the territory? Or do you say, I don't want that. I didn't sign up for this. Many of you know my friend Prince Plattner. Prince, Mary and I first met Prince and Marty back in 1977 when we were living in Tulsa and they helped start a church in their home back over there. And if you were to go to Prince today and you would say, how are you doing, Prince? You know, how would he answer? Blessed. That's his, he's just disciplined himself to answer blessed. He told me one time, he said, I answer that way for two reasons. He said, first, because I am blessed. And he says, no matter what my circumstances are, I'm blessed. He said, but the other reason I answer that is because it gives me an opportunity often to engage in a spiritual conversation. Because then I can say, I'm blessed. How are you? Person says, I'm fine. You can say, you're not blessed? I mean, it can open up all kinds of a spiritual conversation with a stranger. So how are you? Are you blessed? The reason that Prince can say he's blessed is not because he's done a bunch of stuff to gain the blessing of God. That's what you need to understand out of all of this. You can't do this. If you hear this message and go, I need to go out and be more poor, and I need to go out and be more hungry, and do no. The blessing of God is not something that you purchase with your poverty or with your hunger. If you're poor and hungry, it's an indication that God's already blessed you because you recognize the reality of your spiritual condition, which most people don't. So Jesus says you're blessed if you're poor because you realize it. It's not that you have to be poor to earn the blessing. It's that those who are poor already show an indication that they have the blessing. If we recognize our spiritual poverty, our hunger and thirst to be righteous, to mourn our sin and declare our allegiance to Jesus even in the face of persecution, we are blessed. Why? Because God is for us. And if God is for us, what? Who can be against us? Because God will never leave us or forsake us. Because God has adopted us as his beloved children. But hear me clearly. Jesus is not saying you earn the blessing of God by being poor in spirit or hungry or mourning or being persecuted. The fact is you're already blessed when you start to realize your spiritual neediness. Start to hate your sin. Start to long to be righteous. That's an indication that the blessing of God's already with you. So here's the question. Why does God choose to bless anybody? Why does God choose to bless anyone? And the answer is because of Christ. Why does God choose to bless anyone? Because of Christ. The blessing of God is a gift that God gives to Jesus and that Jesus gives to us. The wages of sin is what? Death. But the good news of God, the blessing of God, is eternal life in Christ. Just as Ephesians 2 says, that we have been saved, we are in the state of blessedness, a state of grace, by grace through faith, not of yourself, lest anyone should boast. It's a gift from God. If you're blessed today, it's not because you've earned the blessing, it's because Christ, who did earn the blessing, gives it to you as a free gift.